From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Jiminy Glick is the obese, self-absorbed, misinformed celebrity interviewing talk show host created by Martin Short. Now Glick is the star of a new film. On today's Fresh Air, Martin Short tells us about creating the character. Also, jazz pianist Keith Jarrett. He celebrates his 60th birthday on Sunday. He tells us how he started playing the piano at a very early age, and we'll hear selections from his new solo improvised concert CD. We remember Army Colonel David Hackworth. He died Wednesday at the age of 74. He was the basis for the character Colonel Kurtz in the movie Apocalypse Now. And film critic David Edelstein on Crash. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The Martin Short character Jiminy Glick lampooned celebrity interviews on the Comedy Central series Primetime Glick. Now Glick is starring in a new movie, Jiminy Glick in La La Wood. Grotesquely overweight and intellectually shallow, Jiminy Glick interviews real celebrities who endure his irreverent and often irrelevant questions. One of the celebrities he interviews in the film is Kurt Russell.
Tell me about Elvis Presley.
Elvis?
I love Elvis! Tell me about him!
I was 10 years old, I guess, and he was coming down onto the set in his car.
And... Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. And then you end up playing Elvis. How does that feel? It's like a full journey, I suppose.
Yeah, it was. It was,
I mean, I'm just theorizing here. I don't know if I'm right on this theory, but it seems like if you meet someone, then you do him.
I didn't meet him and do him, but I mean...
I mean that if you meet him and...
You know, and then play him.
And play him.
Yeah.
Did you have any instinct then that his daughter might end up marrying Michael Jackson?
I was a 10-year-old kid. I wasn't looking into the future.
Nick Cage?
That she would marry Nick Cage?
Yes.
No.
Martin Short got his start doing sketch comedy on SCTV and Saturday Night Live, where he created the characters Ed Grimley, Jackie Rogers Jr., and songwriter Irving Cohen. His cable show Primetime Glick last aired on Comedy Central in 2003. Here's a typical interview from the series. Martin Short as Jiminy asks actor Brendan Fraser about his first movie role.
You know, let me ask you this.
Your first film was Encino Man.
Yes?
Oh, I love that. You played Link.
I did, yeah.
Then you play a Jew. You played a Jewish man.
Yes, I did.
And that was risky to play a Jew in Hollywood. In the 90s. What went through your head taking that kind of risk?
Well, I made sure that it was a film that had meaning.
But why a Jew?
Well, the character was actually just a kid. He was a football player, and he just wanted to belong. And he was willing to do anything to be a part of a group. Even to deny who he was fundamentally as a person.
That's wrong. You should embrace whoever you are.
Well, that was the point.
If you're a Buddhist, be happy you're a Buddhist. If you're Muslim, be happy that you're Muslim. If you're Episcopalian, hide that fact.
Terry spoke to Martin Short in 2002.
Are your interviews on Primetime Glick scripted? When you have on real celebrities and you're playing this satire of a celebrity interviewer, do the real celebrities know what you're going to ask in advance, and have they already had a chance to think through how they're going to respond?
No, none of it is planned and none of it's scripted. No one knows what I'm going to say, and I don't know what I'm going to say. I have pages in front of me that have facts about the celebrity. And often, I won't even look at it until the last second because Jiminy wouldn't look at it till the last second.
Right, and you have a way of choosing the most unimportant movie that an actor's made to zero in on. Why is it so important for Jiminy Glick to always be in touch with celebrities?
I don't know. I think that Jiminy is someone who thrives on this shallow world of celebrity. When I started the show, and then it went on the air, and then I would read some response to it, only the positive, of course, that would claim great, you know, declarations of intent, you know, the ultimate satire of a form of a blanket of blank, and I would just say, absolutely. But it's not always true. Sometimes you set up by just saying that this character, if you met him in life, whether he was a teacher or whether he was a politician or whether he was a celebrity interviewer, would make you laugh because of his strange, sincere take on the world and how wrong it is.
No. One of Jiminy Glick's trademarks is that he's very self-absorbed, so when he's interviewing a celebrity, he's also talking about himself a lot and talking about his adventures with other celebrities and his wife and his past. Have you met a lot of interviewers like that where it seems to be more about them than it is about you?
I was interviewed once for a show and the I'm not gonna say who it was because he's kind of known and you it seems mean, but he would end up talking about himself to the degree that I in my mind I was thinking it's been about 4 minutes since I've spoken, and it was an interview not unlike this where it was just, you know, supposed to be an interview with me.
So what did that bring out in you?
You know what I do? I truthfully, it brings out no reaction other than laughter, whether I can laugh then or laugh later.
Now, one of the things that the Jiminy Glick show does is break for commercials, as most broadcast shows do, but these are all satirical commercials. I thought maybe we could break for one of your commercials from Primetime Glick, and this is a commercial for the Independent Film Channel.
This Monday on the Independent Movie Channel's Best of the Fest, Robin Herker's Explaining Carlo, the explosive story of two young heroin addicts who drive cross-country and strike up a relationship with two Texas lesbians. Then on Tuesday, two different lesbians on their way to L.A. strike up a relationship with a heroin-addicted ex-security guard from Texas in Kira Sandoval's controversial The Wisdom of Sarah Finkelman. Then on Wednesday, two ex-lesbians are drawn back into their former lifestyle when they pick up three heroin-addicted hitchhikers.
That's one of the very funny satirical commercials from Martin Short's show, Prime Time Glick. Do you write any of those commercials yourself?
Yes.
Good. They're very funny.
Yeah. Well, I work with two brilliant guys. One is Michael Short and one is Paul Flaherty. And the three of us create the show together.
Is Michael Short a relation?
Yes, he's a brother.
Uh-huh.
And my big brother, Mike.
Is Paul Flaherty related to...
Joe Flaherty,
Joe
brother.
Joe Flaherty, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, wow. All in the family.
They're all obviously I grew up with Michael, but I met Paul on SCTV, which Michael also wrote.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you did imaginary TV shows when you were a kid. Were any of them interview shows where you got to interview the guests?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, there were variety. Variety interview, you know. I'd come out, sing a few numbers. I had, you know, a huge orchestra. And then I would sit down. I would get, you know, Playboy magazine, and I would, you know, read the interview with, I don't know, Norman Lear, and I'd do both voices. So I do a hard-hitting interview in the midst of, you know, doing a medley of songs that weren't nominated or something.
So when you were young and you were watching all these TV shows and doing your imaginary show, did you have any training? Did your mother say, send this boy to acting school or give him singing lessons, develop that talent?
No. My mother was the concert mistress of the symphony. She was the first female concertmaster, actually. So I grew up with, at times during the season, 5 hours of practice heard within the house on a violin. So the idea of rehearsal and opening night was not foreign. But no, I think growing up in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, you don't instinctively, Broadway isn't down the street, so it all seems not terribly realistic. I took piano lessons, but I never stated I was going to be an actor. It wasn't a realistic declaration. And I was always drawn toward, reality in that respect. So it wasn't until I was in university and having done theater throughout university, realized that there was actually an acting scene in Toronto, Ontario, which was 40 miles away, and that it was not inconceivable to take a year off school and try it.
Did your mother measure talent according to more classical standards of rigorous studies and a more legit kind of singing voice than you probably had? You had a more pop voice.
No, you know what? It was very interesting. She was always very encouraging. In fact, I have, when I was 15, Frank Sinatra had released an album called September of My Years. And I re-recorded that. I titled all the lyrics. And I had an attic bedroom, and the hallway to the bedroom was kind of had an echo to it. So I set up my chair. I had a microphone, reel-to-reel. And I would play the introductions from the Sinatra album. But it would be, and of course, Frank was 53, and I was 14. But the introductions would be in his key, so it would be... Do 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 moon do 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 moon do 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 and here click. Strangers in the night too long. I was in Frank's keys. But I would do the album and it would take me about a week, I'd make up an album cover and then my mother, I remember, listened to it and critiqued it because she used to adjudicate at certain violin contests and things in her life. And so she wrote a synopsis of a critique of each song and this, the pitch was very good, lovely old song, well phrased at the end, hold the note too long here, and rated on a 4 stars, 3 stars, 3.5 stars, you know. So I still have that.
Wait, was that helpful?
It was helpful. I think it was mainly helpful because someone was taking my fantasy world very seriously and treating it with credibility and respect. You know, Frank Sinatra once said that his father was always around to piss on his dreams. And I think it's very important for parents to constantly nurture and support eclectic interests of their children, because you never know which one is going to develop, become the fuel that, you know, drives their life.
Getting back to the to Primetime Glick, Jiminy Glick has a sidekick and band leader whose name is Adrian Van Voorhees, a great name, I have to say, and he plays harp. Michael McKean plays the character. Can you talk about coming up with this character?
Well, I certainly didn't come up with the character Michael did, but we kind of wrote it in a direction. It was... You kind of find that the more things you do with characters, the more you come up with it. We'd be writing something, and Michael would come in, and he'd say, Michael said, you know, I want to play him like he's older, but he wears a lot of makeup to hide it. So that becomes part of the character. Is he married, we discussed? Yeah, he's married 4 times, no children, Michael said one day. So that becomes part of the character.
Mm-hmm.
Does he like Jiminy? He doesn't dislike Jiminy, but it's a job. So if Jiminy insults him or cuts him off, he goes, very good, no problem, because it's a job. One of the episodes, his first wife, who's around 85, is on. It's one of those scenarios where we assume that he's married. His first wife was 20 years older. She's a horn player, and he just loses it. And there's a tape of Buddy Rich, pirated tape of Buddy Rich screaming at the band on a bus. Wants his band, and so we made that Adrian Van Voorhees. So we come back from commercial, and he's just berating. Clams, you're hitting nothing but clams, you know. And so that's a new side of Adrian, the side of Adrian losing it. So that's what makes that stuff fun, is you keep saying, what if Adrian, you know, was in a bad mood this show, or what if Adrian gets hurt? I interviewed Michael last year, Michael McKean, as Adrian, and the idea was that Russell Crowe hadn't shown up, and now we had to interview Adrian Van Voorhees. And at one point, again, it's all improvised, I asked him something about, I made some comment about the fact that he wasn't terribly educated, that was that ever a limitation as a musician? And Michael's face completely changed, and he started to tear up, real tears. And there was a split second that even I, as Jiminy, thought, wait a second, have I mentioned something that's actually gotten Michael upset. I mean, it was so real. And he then proceeded to let me know, as Adrian Van Voorhees, that this was a very hurtful subject for him, and I could be hurtful sometimes and insensitive. And that he was always, you know, it was a sore spot for him, his lack of education. And it was an amazing exercise to watch, even after all these years of improvising, to see someone that into it and to make it that real.
So how did your character, Jiminy Glick, react when...
He became very, oh my God, Adrian, I so didn't mean that. I mean, he became a little bit attentive to the possibility that he'd gone too far. You know, Jiminy Glick has no intention of hurting anyone. And when people get upset, when they walk off or they storm out, what have I done? Someone explain to me what I have done. He doesn't know.
Well, Martin Short, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Actor Martin Short speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. Short's new movie is Jiminy Glick in La La Wood. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film Crash. This is Fresh Air. The writer and director Paul Haggis made his mark nearly a decade ago on a critically acclaimed and very short-lived Crimeland TV series called Easy Streets, and his Million Dollar Baby screenplay was nominated for an Oscar. His new feature film Crash features a large cast and a story of colliding cars and racial conflict. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Between the conception and the creation falls the shadow, wrote T.S. Eliot, and I know he wasn't writing about movies, but there are two this week where the conception is worthy of the Nobel Peace Prize and the creation is, well, there's no getting around it, lousy. Kingdom of Heaven is an epic about Christian crusaders who also happen to be liberal humanists willing to die in the name of religious tolerance. That's just weird. But Crash, that in conception has potential. The movie is an ensemble drama set in L.A. and in the style of Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. Characters rudely collide with other characters in multiple and crisscrossing plots. The theme is racism. Let me say that again. The theme is racism. I could say it 500 more times because that's how many times the movie says it in every scene. The director and co-writer, Paul Haggis, wrote Million Dollar Baby, and he thinks like a pugilist. He softens you up with a series of blows to the head, then he pummels your gut, then he hammers you a few inches lower. He's so relentless that you have to laugh. But you're also transfixed because the actors are going full throttle, and the movie makes a show of its own momentousness. In the opening, the camera prowls the site of a car crash, and a homicide detective, played by Don Cheadle, narrates. What's missing in L.A., he says, is the sense of touch. Everyone is always behind metal and glass. Then he says, we crash just so we can feel something. I know it's a metaphor, but it still made me groan. Then Cheadle gazes at the twinkly, blurry lights of L.A., and Mark Isham's synthesized keyboards get all shimmery. You know you're about to see a lot of lonely, angry, vulnerable people lashing out at a lot of other lonely, angry, vulnerable people. After the overture, Haggis cuts to the hip-hop guy Ludacris and Lawrence Tate, two young black guys strolling down an affluent white city block. Ludacris holds forth on the outrageous racist fear that white people have of black men. Then he pulls out a gun and carjacks a fancy SUV belonging to Brendan Fraser and Sandra Bullock. Fraser plays the callowly ambitious LADA. Bullock is the wife who, at home, she's horrified by a Spanish locksmith played by Michael Peña.
I want the locks changed again in the morning.
You want? Look, why don't you just go lie down, huh? Have you checked on James?
Well, of course I've checked on James. I've checked on him every 5 minutes since we've been home. Do not patronize me. I want the locks changed again in the morning.
Shh, it's okay. Just go to bed, all right?
Do you know what? Didn't I just ask you not to treat me like a child?
I'm sorry, Miss Jean. It's okay, I go home now.
It's fine. Thank you very much for staying, Maria.
You're welcome, no problem. Good night, Miss Jean.
Good night.
We'll see you tomorrow.
I would like the locks changed again in the morning. And you know what? You might mention that we'd appreciate it if next time they didn't send a gang member.
A gang member?
Yes, yes.
Well, you mean that kid in there?
Yes, the guy in there with the shaved head, the pants around his ass, the prison tattoo.
Those are not prison tattoos.
Oh, really? And he's not going to go sell our key to one of his gangbanger friends the moment he is out our door.
We've had a really tough night. I think it'd be best if you just went upstairs right now.
And what, wait for them to break in? I just had a gun pointed in my face.
You lower your voice.
And it was my fault because I knew it was going to happen. But if a white person sees two black men walking towards her and she turns and walks in the other direction, she's a racist, right? Well, I got scared and I didn't say anything. And 10 seconds later, I had a gun in my face. Now, I am telling you, your amigo in there is going to sell our key to one of his homies. And this time it'd be really f***ing great if you acted like you actually gave a shit.
The irony is that Bullock is picking on Crash's one saint, a guy who only wants to protect his adorable little daughter. Everyone else is warped by fear and rage. Matt Dillon plays a cop whose old dad is sick and in pain. But a black woman insurance supervisor named Shaniqua won't okay a specialist. Dillon hates what he calls affirmative action hires, so he stops a wealthy black couple, Terrence Howard and Tandy Newton, and sexually molests the woman, while his partner, played by Ryan Phillippe, looks on in horror. Later, Dylan and Newton will be reunited under different circumstances, and we'll see that Dylan can be brave and selfless. And Phillippe will come to the aid of Howard, and then do something horrible to another black man. Crash says that when you scratch a vicious racist, you get a caring human. But when you push a caring human, you can get a vicious racist. The complex dramatic architecture and the admirable message that we must transcend our boundaries can't disguise the tidiness of that formulation. Haggis wants to distill all the resentment among races and all the hypocrisy into one fierce parable, but he's too much a creature of 1930s socially conscious melodrama. His shopworn dramaturgy makes this portrait of how we live now seem ludicrous, and I don't mean the hip-hop guy. A universe in which we're all racist puppets is finally just as simple-minded and predictable as one in which we're all smiling, multicolored zombies under the rainbow. It's hard to be elevated when you're feeling so talked down to.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin. Available in stores and online at bn.com. And from Bantam, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Creating a Legacy of Physical and Emotional Health by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Music from the new solo improvised CD by Keith Jarrett. Coming up, we feature an interview with Jarrett. He celebrates his 60th birthday this Sunday. And we remember Army Colonel David Hackworth, one of the military's most highly decorated officers and a combat legend in Vietnam. He died Wednesday at the age of 74. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. One of the most famous pianists in jazz, Keith Jarrett, a musician acclaimed for his emotionally intense and physically energetic improvised solo piano performances, has had to keep his playing to a minimum. Jarrett has had chronic fatigue syndrome since 1996. But he's significantly recovered from his most debilitating period of CFS, in part through a careful regimen of diet, exercise, and rest. Jarrett has just released Radiance, a CD of his concert performances in Japan recorded in 2002. These performances marked his return to the demanding format of extended improvised solo piano.
Thank you.
of the music in this concert was improvised, with nothing preconceived before Jarrett sat down to play. In his liner notes, he wrote, "I wanted my hands, especially the left hand, to tell me things. This is part of the process I wanted to experiment with. The listener has to bear with me here. The whole thing is risky, but I've taken you places before, and I'm not aiming to disappoint." Jarrett grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and was a piano prodigy from childhood. Terry spoke with him in 2000.
You started taking lessons, piano lessons, when you were three, which I think is uncommonly early. Why did your parents get you a teacher at such a young age?
Well, they discovered I had perfect pitch. So,
how did they discover that?
Well, there was an old converted player piano. Was just in the house, and I think no one really played it at all. And I ended up sitting at the piano, picking out melodies that were coming out of the radio. And I guess they figured it out that something was going on here. You know, this should either get him away from that instrument or get him a teacher.
A lot of people barely have any memories from the time that they were 3 years old. Do you have many memories of those very early piano lessons?
Not really. I remember the gate at the top of my piano teacher's stairway, so that I guess the little kid she taught wouldn't fall down the stairs. It's like, I think I remember that the piano was to the left of the top of the stairs, but I don't remember anything else.
And you don't remember what you were first taught to play?
Not really, no.
Do you remember what you were praised or criticized for by that first teacher?
Nope. I don't. I really don't. I don't remember. I'm sure it was a woman, and that's about all I know. I do remember, however, a few years later when I got my second, I believe it was my second teacher, who was, of course, a more serious piano teacher. At the point I was at, I guess it was a given that there was something happening here. And they had to try to find someone who took me further. I don't know how old I was, but I do know that I hated this guy, and I do know that now I believe he probably gave me the most of any teacher in such a short time. And he did not let me use the pedal. He gave me only Bartok. And I was just a little kid. I mean, Bartok was not particularly pleasant music for a little kid to be learning. And I played the violin at the time. I started to play the violin, and I really liked that too. And one day he said, and I guess he had I think he was German. He had an accent. He said, "You must choose." And I said, "What?" He said, "You must choose which instrument you play." And I said, "Oh, you have to be kidding. I like them both." "Well, you have great talent, but you have to put this talent in one instrument." And I went home, and I was really upset, and I didn't know what to do, and he wasn't going to teach me, you know. So I eventually chose the piano, I guess partially based on the fact that I played it a little longer. But he was right about all the things he taught me. I mean, there's such an... the pedal is something you can really overuse to the point of covering up what you're unable to do. He just disciplined me in an important way.
As you got a little bit older in your preteen and teen years, did playing piano earn you the admiration or the mockery of friends? Friends can sometimes really mock you for being very serious about something.
Yeah. I was a normal kid by the time I was in junior high and high school, which were public schools. I just was a normal kid. I mean, I didn't want to practice. I went out and wanted to play basketball. If my grandmother wasn't in the kitchen, I'd move the timer forward that was supposed to go off when I was able to stop practicing. That kind of thing. And she probably knew I was doing it, but she was so kind-hearted that she didn't, you know, she didn't ever...
Whose idea was the timer?
Probably my mother's, because she wasn't home, and so my grandmother was keeping this 2.5 hour practice schedule or whatever it was I had at the time.
Did you resent having to practice that much?
Well, I did, and then I would say something, or I might say something about it, and my parents would say, well, you know, we don't have that much money, we'll sell the piano. And I would immediately give up my position because I loved doing that. So, I knew that playing piano was important to me.
You know, I think a lot of musicians who started off as prodigies go through a period where they're really confused about whether they're staying in music because they love music or whether they're staying in music because it's what they've always done and it's what people have always expected them to do and it's what adults almost required them to do.
Yeah.
And some former prodigies go through a period of rebelling against music and against the discipline that's been enforced all their lives. Did you go through a period like that ever?
No. No. No, I think I had a calling, and I think I knew that from the time I have any memories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't go through that. I just would have rather been out playing basketball. You know, I thought, I can get this practicing in some other time.
Your parents divorced when you were 11. Did that interfere with your ability to focus on music?
I think it made me more ferociously focused on music. One phenomenal thing about being a musician, and in particular, I guess, playing an instrument that doesn't need other instruments to play with, like a piano or a guitar, is that you can change any mental state or emotional state you're in into music. And it's a transformative thing. And I mean, I learned that at a very, very young age. If I was angry, I'd go play the piano. And I might not play angry music, but everything is energy. And it you can change the direction those arrows are pointing. It's just you have to use the energy somehow. And when I sometimes talk to my sons, who are both musicians and want to be, you know, in music, that's about the best thing I can say about music, that it's for the player. You know, it's a way of knowing where you're at and what you're feeling.
Jazz pianist Keith Jarrett speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. He has a new solo recording called Radiance. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Keith Jarrett. When they left off, they were talking about his childhood when he was a classical prodigy. Terry asked him how he realized he wanted to play jazz.
Well, when I heard jazz in Allentown in my early teens, probably 12, 13, and I think I heard Andre Previn because, you know, Allentown was not a center of jazz culture. I think the Woolworths that I got these records from probably made a mistake and bought a couple jazz albums they didn't intend to. And he lucked out, and actually they were mostly people like Andre Previn. And then I heard Oscar Peterson, and then I heard Brubeck Live in Allentown, and I remember when I was in the audience, I remember listening and saying, this is really great, but there's more to do. Now, I was a kid, you know, and I'm thinking, he's not doing everything that you could do in this situation. So I already knew something was, you know, that I was going to contribute something, I guess. And I heard Basie Live a couple times. That was great. And I actually sat in with Stan Kenton when he had that giant band, and there's a lot of experiences I had that probably I couldn't trade for any other kind of learning experience.
You went to New York, scuffled there for a while.
Yeah.
Eventually started to get noticed. Then you started playing with Charles Lloyd. And after that, went with Miles Davis. Apparently, he invited you to join his band several times before you accepted. Why did you turn down Miles Davis?
I said no to Miles because I had work for my trio. And I was in the middle of setting up tours with the trio. And I remember telling him that if there's a break in my schedule with the trio, that I would be happy to play with the with his group, and I want to, but I'm not sure if he was had already gone electric. He probably had, and that was another thing that was easy to say no to. It wasn't that attractive from that point of view. If my memory serves me, when the trio came back from Europe, Miles had said, well, whenever you feel like it, just come down and play. And, you know, it doesn't matter. You just come down wherever we're playing and sit in with the band and play. And so that's what eventually happened. I think it was Philadelphia.
You certainly pioneered the solo piano concert, which eventually really caught on and spread to other instruments as well. What was it like in the early days being alone out there on the stage and improvising on your own?
It started out maybe as a result of recording Facing You. I can't remember, but it started out, I remember at the Heidelberg Jazz Festival where I was supposedly... I wasn't very well known, I guess, and I came out and did a solo thing, and it was tunes, but I started to connect them somehow. Like I'd have these transitional parts that connected everything. And then that somehow just moved slowly into the expanded solo concert where there are no songs whatsoever and everything is improvised on the spot. I don't know. Someone once sent me a note from the audience that's saying, you must be awfully alone. You must feel awfully alone or something like that. And I realized when I read that that was true. It is a terribly, it's a lonely thing to do. I mean, you're not even bringing material along for companionship.
Right.
So it was a sort of, I wish I could think of a word, but it was sort of like having a seance with the audience. So it wasn't all that lonely in the midst of it. But as a rule, the mechanism of doing it, traveling alone and you know, just going up there on an empty stage with a piano. I guess if I thought about it, it would have scared the hell out of me, but I didn't think much about it other than it was a challenge.
In the 70s, I think a lot of your fans debated with each other whether you were black or white.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the same Heidelberg Festival, there were some black musicians or black audience members trying to disrupt my performance because they claimed it wasn't black music. And of course it wasn't. One reason was I wasn't black, but this was a jazz festival. They were claiming it. Not only was it not black music, but it wasn't jazz, and it shouldn't be at this festival. And this was, I guess, during the time when, you know, the black Muslim thing was pretty big, and uh-huh. I went backstage afterwards, and I was rather heartbroken because I thought, gee, these are fellow musicians or like people who like music, and why are they doing this? And I was just sitting alone in my dressing room, probably very upset. And a man and his daughter knocked on the door, blacker than any of the guys who were trying to disrupt the stuff on stage, who was actually from Central Africa. And he and his daughter came back and said, "Mr. Jarrett, we just want to say that was so beautiful. And I thought, okay, well, this is going to be just a political problem for me. It isn't the music, it's just the politics.
Do you think that a lot of people assumed you were African-American because your hair is really curly and looked like an afro?
Yeah, and a friend of my ex-wife's was arguing with me and her that I had to be black, no matter what I said. And once Ornette backstage said something.
Is it Ornette Coleman?
Yeah, Ornette Coleman. One of the earliest times I was in the same room with him, he said something like, man, you got to be black. You just have to be black. I said, I know. I'm working on it.
What, do you think that worked in your favor?
Well, it didn't hurt, you know. I don't think it hurt to be when I get that kind of feedback from the actual players who I felt were partly my inspirations, who happen to be black. Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's a compliment.
Well, Keith Jarrett, I'm really glad you're playing again and recording again, and thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you very much for the interest.
Keith Jarrett speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. On Sunday, he celebrates his 60th birthday. He has a new solo recording called Radiance. Jarrett will perform June 22nd at Carnegie Hall with bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Jack DeJohnette. And a DVD of his complete Tokyo concert will be released in the fall. Coming up, we remember a soldier's soldier, Colonel David Hackworth, who died earlier this week. This is Fresh Air. Retired Army Colonel David Hackworth, one of the most decorated and controversial officers in the modern military, died Wednesday in Mexico at the age of 74. Hackworth was said to have been the model for the character of the renegade Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando in the film Apocalypse Now, but that label doesn't begin to capture his life and career. Hackworth was born on Armistice Day in 1930, and after running away from an orphanage, he enlisted in the Army at age 15. Fighting in Korea, he won his first Silver Star before he was old enough to vote, and was wounded 4 times before that conflict ended. In 1965, he went to Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division. He served 6 years in Vietnam, earning a reputation as one of the Army's toughest, most dedicated, and innovative soldiers. Known in the theater as Hack, he was usually seen wearing jungle fatigues and clenching a cigar in the corner of his mouth. But Hackworth grew disillusioned with the war and the American military and detailed his reasons in a 1971 interview on the ABC program Issues and Answers. Vietnam, he said, was a bad war, one which can't be won, and he predicted the Saigon regime would fall within 4 years. Though his prediction would prove accurate, his comments ignited a national controversy, and military leaders did their best to discredit him. Hackworth left the Army after the interview, moved to Australia, and eventually wrote a best-selling memoir called About Face. He later served as a correspondent for Newsweek in the Gulf War. Terry Gross spoke with Hackworth in 1989 when About Face was published. She asked him to talk about his experiences training and leading troops.
50% of all casualties in Vietnam came from mines and booby traps, from these little insidious damn things that blew up and tore off your leg or killed you. And the total training that was given on mines and booby traps were 5 hours. There was no training devices like a little firecracker device that would explode when the soldier went through a training field and spray him with red paint so he'd know that he tripped a mine and was wounded. But at the same time, every full colonel and above in Vietnam had an air-conditioned trailer. And I became so insane about the way we were training, and I needed to know what it was all about and what we were happening, that I put on a private's uniform and wore a private's dog tags, a boy named Bob Cena, and went right through the training so I could find out what was happening. And I was appalled with what was happening. And so I took my troopers and trained them at night and trained them on Saturday and Sundays and so on to ensure that they got the right stuff. Because when they finished that training, they were on a jet airplane, and a few days later, they were walking in the jungles of Vietnam.
One of your missions in Vietnam was to take over a sick battalion, a battalion that was in disarray, and to try to turn them around. When you got there and saw the troops, you found that at the command post there were portable toilets, plastic coolers, but the troops were living in complete filth and disarray. They weren't even covering their feces. That there was just this incredible difference between how the two groups were living. Would you describe that a little bit?
Well, that was the 4th Battalion, 39th. They kind of called themselves the Hard Luck Battalion, because shy of my arriving, they had kind of waited around in minefields for 6 months and taken 500 or 600 casualties and hadn't really engaged the enemy. And it was a very demoralized unit. And in Vietnam, minefields were where the enemy was. The whole focus was on body count. So you went into minefields, and it just blew the guys' brains away, because every time they put their foot down, they didn't know whether they were going to have a foot, going to have a leg, going to have a life. And do that for 365 days, and hey, it'll do something to your brain. And so I had to change that, and I had to win these young 19 and 20-year-old boys to my way of fighting, which was, I'm on your side. I am not going to waste you. You are the most precious asset in the world, and I'm not going to just slam you up against a minefield or an enemy in a fixed position for glory or for a few medals or to make some points with my boss. And so I was a very frugal commander, and that spirit went down to my troops. And within 5 months, that battalion started calling themselves the Hardcore Battalion. And they, at the end, had killed over 2,500 enemy at the price of 25 American dead, 25 of our comrades who were killed. And that is, to me, the end result. If you could do that with a drafty battalion that started in that kind of raggedy condition, and they turned out to be a Praetorian Guard, it was just a byproduct, Terry, of leadership.
When you retired from the military and your own military record was called into question, a couple of the things that were raised were controversial things that you had been doing while you were in Vietnam. Like, for instance, you ran, a massage parlor whorehouse?
Well, I had the best little whorehouse this side of the Mekong Delta River. But what was important, the reason that we had it was not unlike the French Army when they were in Vietnam. They had the same type of service for their little troops. And it was because we had syphilis that was in epidemic proportions around this area. We had heroin in the same kind of condition. So I put everything off limits. And warriors are warriors, and they like to fight, and they like to do other good things. Instead of taking the problem of having the heroin brought into my base or the syphilis brought in, we corrected that by providing that good service for the Allied troops. And, you know, the function of a good commander is to look after his soldiers, and I always looked after my soldiers.
You had a heroin amnesty program. Describe briefly how the program worked.
Well, at that time, about 20% of the U.S. command in Vietnam had a problem with heroin. And so what I did with my doc, a medical doctor, medically trained and all that good stuff, was was very easy to see who was sticking a needle in his arms, because we were in the tropics and they had their sleeves rolled down. So it was just a question of identifying those guys, putting them under a medical program the doc ran. He brought them down on morphine, and then we got them home. And the Army's way of dealing with this was to give everyone a bad conduct discharge. And I felt that they were victims, not unlike they'd been shot on the battlefield. And I felt it was my responsibility to get them home in good order. And so that's what our program was about. At the end, when they went out through Camp Alpha, they had to urinate in a little bottle, and this bottle could be read, and it could be told if they had been on heroin in the last 6 or 8 months. So I just sent another boy with them. We just out-G'd the whole system, and the other boy took a leak in the bottle, and they read out his urine, and the guy that had been using the heroin went home and was free, and he didn't have a $300 or $400 a day habit, and he could walk away from that terrible experience. So again, I was looking after my troops, and as long if I hadn't bit the hand that fed me, none of this would have come up. But
did you get away with it for as long as you did?
Well, we were very competent and good, and we were winning all the ball games. And it's my experience that the commanders will suffer all kinds of insubordination and bizarre, weird behavior as long as you're winning ball games. And we indeed won ball games right until the day I left that country.
Retired Army Colonel David Hackworth speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Hackworth died Wednesday. He was 74. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, online at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a concert and interview with jazz pianist Dave Burrell. He'll tell us how he fell in love with the music of Jelly Roll Morton and how it changed his own playing and composing. Join us for the next Fresh Air.